Welcome, welcome, welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Happy Thursday, friends. We got a big show today, Avi. Lot to talk about.
What's coming up on the show today, Cherry?
Well, our newsmaker is all about Daniel's Law. It's an effort in New Jersey to protect the private information of judges, police, and other similar officials. It's causing some unintended negative consequences, though. And I don't know if you remember that, remember this, but the law was implemented after a New Jersey judge's son was murdered in her home by a disgruntled lawyer who had been stalking their family because they found their private information online.
Data privacy is such a hot topic right now, and this is one of the strictest laws in the nation. Yeah. So we're going to explore how, but also how that can have some ripple effects. So Matt Friedman's going to join us from Politico at the end of this segment. Then the middle segment, Cherry.
Coyote, possums, and bears. Oh, my.
That's a nice adaptation
Thank
of the phrase.
You.
And speaking of adaptation, many types of wildlife have adapted to living with us in urban and semi-urban spaces. And we're going to bring on an expert to talk about how they've done that, how we should interact with them, how certain species can be beneficial to us as humans, and how to respect their habitat, which is also our habitat.
We can share. We can live together. Maybe not actually together, but
yeah,
in close
together-ish.
Yeah. And our final segment will have a guest by Kari Sellers. You probably heard his name. He's a CNN political analyst and three-time author. His latest book is titled The Moment, and we'll talk about it and why he argues that the post-George Floyd racial reckoning fell short.
And if you want to seize the moment to participate in this conversation, you can call us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. Now some headlines, Cherry, and we're going to start in Delaware. Three pieces of legislation just made it out of the Judiciary Committee in Delaware, all of them related to gun control. One of the ones that really caught our attention would ban guns on college campuses. We just saw a tragic incident where a young woman was killed on the campus of Delaware State University. She was not a student, although she was planning to attend Delaware State. And so this bill would bar a person who knowingly possesses a firearm while in or on a college or university facility or campus universities and colleges. And so we'll see if it actually gets to the finish line. But this is an attempt to create sort of gun-free zones on college campuses. I didn't know this actually until I was reading about this bill and doing some research, that there are some states in which they tell colleges and universities you are not even allowed to ban guns on your campus. Then there's the middle section of states who say it's up to the individual school. Individual school discretion. And then there are some states, like Delaware is hoping to become, or some in Delaware hope it becomes, where the schools are not given a choice in the other direction. They're told you have to ban guns on all campuses. So Delaware might be moving in that direction.
And we will see. But I'll tell you, this is part of a nationwide push. I mean, because it's really sad that shootings on campus are not rare anymore. And we had 13 deadly shootings on college campuses last year alone. And so, you know, now, you know, Del State has to deal with this situation on campus where a young woman who was visiting to see if she wanted to go there was shot and killed. And so, you know, college campuses can be emotional places, a lot of stressed out individuals, they're young. And so if you have a gun on campus, you're more likely to use it, right? And so they're hoping that this ban would make it less likely that we would have shootings on campus. But
another bill that was among these three that I also thought was interesting was about creating a voluntary no-sell list in Delaware. Actually, had not heard of this before. Forgive my ignorance. But this is an idea that people who have mental health challenges could volunteer to be on
Put
a list
on
and say,
list.
Do not ever sell me a weapon. If I ever, you know, claim to change my mind and ask for a weapon, you cannot sell it to me. And this is supposed to, like I said, help people who have mental health challenges. And so it's not a concept I was familiar with, but it looks like Delaware might be moving in that direction as well.
So we'll see. The momentum is coming from the shooting. And this is just one step in getting that law passed. And staying on college campuses, Avi, protests against the war in Gaza have emerged on school campuses nationwide, including in our region. Students at Swarthmore College, they were staging rallies, walkouts and encampments, demanding divestment from Israel and businesses involving the conflict. They prompted school responses and ongoing investigations. You probably heard about the issue at Columbia University.
Well, sure, that's dominating.
That was
news
big,
coverage, yeah.
You know, where over 100 pro-Palestinian demonstrators were arrested there. But we also had, you know, sessions at University of Pennsylvania. They had listening sessions on campus so students could discuss their feelings. University of Delaware students organized a walkout die-in and an encampment in support of Gaza, demanding financial divestment and protections for Palestinians on campus. This is sort of spreading, you know, among a lot of young people. And we talked about this on our political roundtable yesterday.
Sure did.
How a lot of young people feel very strongly about the war in Gaza.
I am surprised we haven't seen more at Penn yet, mm-hmm. specifically because that campus had been activated
yes.
around this issue before October 7th. Mm-hmm. And we all know what happened with the president, who then went to testify and then resigned, Liz McGill. So, you know, just I am a little bit surprised that we haven't seen too much at Penn yet. And maybe that will change. Of course, the end of the semester is coming. So, you know, most likely, even if it does take root at a place like Penn or continues to expand at a place like Swarthmore, there might be a bit of a time limit on this particular part of sort of what you talked about earlier, mm-hmm. the backlash that we're seeing amongst young people. But again, we'll stay tuned.
And I want to mention that there have been concerns of potential violence against Jewish students, which has led to cancellation sometimes of these, you know, events. And so that is also a concern on campuses as well.
Another big national story, TikTok. And TikTok could soon be banned if it does not separate from its Chinese parent company, ByteDance. Of course, this has all been framed as a national security issue. Would the Chinese government use American user data to spy on Americans, to somehow compromise them? But of course, for a lot of local creators, TikTok is just the way that they spread a message or make their living. And we're going to have to see what happens to those folks. We caught a story in NorthJersey.com, put together a list of very popular New Jersey TikTok accounts that they would be sad to see go. I had not heard of any of them because, Cherry, I'll admit, I have never been on TikTok. I confess.
Okay.
In fact, this whole ban thing has made me more curious about TikTok than I ever was before. But so maybe I will. I'll change that stance in the next year. You're active on TikTok, not active?
I'm somewhat active.
Somewhat active.
Yeah. I don't go on it every day, but every so often I do. Yeah. And
what do you seek there?
You know, usually reviews of products.
Yeah.
Yeah, I bought whole skincare regimens based on TikTok
okay.
reviews. But they have great reviews. And yeah. And
I
so,
see. I did not know that. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons. But there are a lot of people do, you know, get a lot of information from TikTok. And there's people who make a lot of money. So these content creators are going to fight back, I'm predicting.
The New Jersey TikToks that they pointed to, the one that caught my eye the most was about vintage New Jersey.
Oh, I thought you were going to pick the Sopranos one.
I've never watched this. I'm not
okay.
into Sopranos.
Okay.
So there is a TikTok account where it takes every Sopranos episode and condenses it into 25 seconds, which I mean, props
That's
that you
skill.
Can do that. That's an amazing skill.
Yeah.
Editing on fleek. But can I say that?
Yes.
Okay. But so, you know, so that's very impressive. But I'm not into The Sopranos. I never watched it. The one that I like is it's called Vintage New Jersey.
Okay.
That was linked in this article. And it's basically like just old footage.
Oh,
yeah.
You
and
love
it's
history.
Just like, yeah, I just
buff.
Love like watching. Like it was like one was like, this is what the Turnpike looked like in 1952 or whatever. I'm like, that's kind of cool.
And you might get a headline of your in there.
I might. I just might. Speaking of headlines,
yeah.
let's transition to our newsmaker now, Jerry.
Yeah, you may remember a few years ago that New Jersey judge Esther Salas's son, Daniel, was murdered by a man targeting her. Out of that tragic case, the state passed a privacy law protecting the personal information of judges like their home address. Daniel's law is named after Judge Salas's son, and since then, the law has been expanded to include police officers and child protective workers.
There have been some interesting consequences since this law went into effect. They include the rise of a cottage industry to bring lawsuits against data broker companies who do not comply with the law. here to tell us more about how one of the country's strictest data privacy laws is playing out in the state of New Jersey is Politico reporter Matt Friedman. Matt, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Matt, I want to start by asking you, how was Daniel's law designed to protect the personal information of people like Judge Salas and others?
Well, because it was such a, it was a quickly passed law, they're kind of learning as they go what works and what doesn't. But essentially, they passed a law that said, okay, if you're a judge, and I think initially law enforcement was also included, you can go on and go to this website and request that your address and phone number not be included in public documents if someone requests it from the government or anything posted online. It evolved over a couple years to include new classes of people. For instance, law enforcement and judges' families. I'm trying to remember if they were initially included or not, but also eventually child protective service workers. Not part of Daniel's law, but in a similar vein, politicians started restricting their own public disclosures to exclude their addresses, and they really sort of cited Daniel's law as a means. So there's been some liberty taken with it to further restrict information, some of which is protecting people by restricting it, and some of which I think is pretty arguable. But that's kind of where we've landed. But it's been evolving over time, and the cottage industry is sort of the it's brand new and kind of the latest development.
Before we get to that, what makes this law different than other data privacy laws, and why are the data brokers in particular seemingly so concerned about it?
Well, instead of just hitting companies with a penalty if they fail to comply, this law includes a private right of action, which is allows anybody to sue a data broker if they request that their information be taken off their website or service and the broker doesn't comply within 10 days.
And who are these data brokers, by the way, Matt? Like, who are their clients? Why do they want this data? What are they doing with this data?
I mean, there's all kinds of reasons to for services like LexisNexis might be the best known one. A lot of it's real estate, credit, identity verification. And, you know, for those of us in the media, I most often would have used LexisNexis until it got too expensive. Other reporters, I most often used it to find unlisted phone numbers if I really needed to call someone and it was pretty urgent and I couldn't find a way to contact them. Or sometimes I would use it not to report on because it's I would have to, but occasionally I'd use it just to get an idea. I could see, you know, someone's voting history. If I wanted to report on that, I would go to the county clerks themselves. But sometimes it was just an easier way to access it to kind of get an idea of where someone was.
And so, Matt, then you have these folks. It sort of opened a Pandora's box for exploitation. How exactly have individuals been these companies been exploiting this law?
Well, so far, I mean, it's just one company, but what I think is interesting about this, and it's not necessarily exploiting it, they say they have good intentions in this and that they're really trying to do something and fill a gap where it's not there. But I think this is a new frontier in data privacy, and I do think it does open the door to possible exploitation. And certainly the data brokers think so and are pushing to amend this law. But essentially what it does in this private right of action, what they did, what the New Jersey legislature did is there was a bill, the headline on the bill, the big stated purpose of the bill was to add child protective service workers to those covered under OPRA's law. Not controversial at all. I saw that. I said, fine. It's, you know, there's a billion bills introduced every year and passed. And this isn't one I really have time to look at. Unbeknownst to me and pretty much everyone else at the time, except Atlas Data Privacy, which had formed recently, and a few other people, is that under that headline was another part of the law, an amendment that did two things when it was amended in committee. One, it said if you're an individual and you want your data removed and the company does not comply, not only could that company face a $1,000 fine, they will face a $1,000 fine. So they took away a judge's discretion.
Yep.
$1,000 fine. They took away the judge's discretion, which there's an ironic twist here, not to get too into it, but they're doing the opposite when it comes to a judge's discretion if a seeker of public records is improperly denied it in terms of getting their legal fees back from the government that they challenged. But that's That's a little aside. But so,
but just because we have limited time here, Matt, I just want to get your thoughts real quickly. How likely is this bill, do you think, to be amended, this law to be amended?
It's really hard to say at this point. You know, these data broker companies can be influential as well. There's so many things that can happen in the legislature and so many possible deals to be cut. But the important thing to note is the other amendment they did was they enabled the person who wants to sue these data brokers to have an assignee of benefits. And that's where this Atlas Data Privacy Company comes around and represents thousands of people and files hundreds of lawsuits.
And it sounds to me like there's a lesson, maybe some legislative, you know, restraint or like, you know, thinking, you know, digging deeper before you pass a law. Any lesson?
I've been doing this for a long time and talking to legislators, and it's quite striking sometimes when legislators don't know, you know, the details of their own bills. That's quite common.
All right.
Well,
that's Matt Freeman, author of Politico's New Jersey Playbook, filling us in on Daniel's Law in New Jersey. Appreciate the time, Matt.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we're talking urban wildlife. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Cherry, headline yesterday, black bear spotted in Ewing Township, New Jersey.
Ooh, yes, I did.
Those headlines hit that all the time, right? Wildlife in urban areas. We had coyotes in Delco last week. And just this morning, according to my sources, Cherry, our producer, Debbie, saw a fox in her backyard.
That's wild. Like, literally wild. So they are clearly out there, these animals and wildlife living among us. But that obviously raises the question, what are we doing? Do we live in actual coexistence? Are we doing enough to protect the urban wildlife? And where could we do better? With us to find answers to all of these questions and much more is Kathleen Kerwin, Associate Wildlife Biologist at Rutgers University. Kathleen, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Kathleen, I'm curious, what types of animals live best among humans? Like, what types of traits do they have?
Great question. So we do have these species of wildlife that are really well adapted to living in urban or even suburban environments. And usually they have some traits all in common. They're typically omnivores, which means they eat both vegetation and meat. And they're generalists, which means they're really not picky about what they can get their hands on to eat. And they will take advantage of human food sources, so things like gardens, your vegetable garden, your landscaping, garbage, pet food that might be outside, or even a bird feeder. They have a very high tolerance for human disturbance, so they might not care if there's loud noises or cars going by or a lot of light pollution. And they're just good at surviving. They are usually very good at reproducing. They have a lot of babies every year, and then those babies will have a high survival rate so that they're making babies the next year too.
Scrappy and not picky.
I love it.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
And so Kathleen, just give us a sort of understanding. What are some of the common and less common urban wildlife we typically see in our region?
So I think most people are familiar with things like red foxes, raccoons, skunks, opossums, pigeons, rats. All of those are very common and things that most people see. Maybe less commonly seen, but still there, are things like coyotes, which have more recently spread into our urban areas. They're also highly adaptable. Black bears, like you mentioned, can be found really anywhere in the state, but they're more concentrated in that northwest corner. I'm sorry, I'm talking about New Jersey, but you guys are in Pennsylvania.
We're following.
Jersey people from Jersey listen. Yes, you can add Jersey in there.
They do require more forested areas, but they will sometimes be seen in more urban areas as they're dispersing and looking for more habitat.
And so, how do these wild animals view humans? Like, do they have a sense of who we are and what dangers we pose and what advantages we may carry? Or are they kind of like sort of oblivious to us?
So they definitely know we're there, and that's kind of why they're thriving, is that they don't care about us for the most part. That we don't bother them. But all wild animals are naturally scared of people. We use the term habituation when you have wild animals that have lost that fear. And usually that happens because they're associating people with a food source. So that usually means that they're getting food, they know people, you know, equals a good meal. And then they lose that fear and they start acting a little differently. They might be more bold. They're not going to run away when they see you, that sort of thing.
And so what should you do if you come in contact with a wild, you know, urban wildlife? I didn't want to just say wild animal because they don't sound wild if you sort of are not afraid. Yeah.
So it depends. If you just see one in the distance and it's acting normal, then you don't have to do much. If you see a wild animal and it's coming towards you or it's not running away from you, then the best thing to do is not to run. Even if that animal is acting aggressively, I mean, of course, if you're near your front door and can get into safety, that's what you should do. But if you're out walking or maybe you're taking a hike, you do not want to run away because that will trigger that animal to chase you and you don't want that to happen. So this is the same advice, the same set of steps you would use from anything from a raccoon that was acting strange to a fox to even a bear. So don't run away. You want to act tall, wave your arms, maybe shout, be really loud. If there's rocks or something nearby, you can throw at the animal. You don't want to try to hurt it, but just try to scare it and put that fear back into it. And an animal acting really aggressive is very, very rare. And for an animal, a wild animal, to even attack a human is even rarer, but it does happen. But that would be the best advice is basically don't run, stand your ground, and if needed, fight back.
How should we think about whether or not to feed animals, to provide food for them? Because it's odd, but people have bird feeders, so they're sort of they'll kind of put their thumb on the ecological scale there and saying, like, I'm encouraging birds to visit my backyard. But then there seems like there's other types of animals where we're told, like don't put food out for them. And I actually am just kind of genuinely confused about what we're supposed to do here.
Yeah, great question. So birds are kind of an exception. Many of our birds, especially songbirds, are on the decline. So putting out a food source can help them, especially on harder times of the year, like during the summer when they are raising babies or when they're getting ready to get through the winter or they're getting ready to migrate somewhere else for the winter. They need to put on weight. So feeding birds is kind of the exception. But when it comes to urban mammals, especially, so those foxes, raccoons, things like that, and deer, especially deer, people love feeding deer. they really don't need our help. Their populations are extremely high, probably to an unnatural level because of all of the help they're getting from us just by the
putting
garbage
our trash out. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they don't need to be intentionally fed by us. And many places that's illegal. You really don't want to do that. They are doing perfectly fine on their own.
Interesting.
And if you are just tuning in, we're talking about urban wildlife with Kathleen Kerwin, associate wildlife biologist at Rutgers University. Kathleen, I want to bring in a question. Nicole asked, I saw a raccoon running along Germantown Avenue in broad daylight, exclamation point. She says, aren't they nocturnal?
We get this question all the time, and it's a great one. A lot of people think if they see a wild animal out in the day that it must be sick, it must have rabies or must have something wrong with it. That might be true, but more often than not, they're just out during the day because, like I said before, they're generalists, they're opportunists. And especially if they have babies to feed, like this time of year, you're going to see them during the day more often simply because they have a lot of mouths to feed and they are just trying to find as much food as possible. So nothing really to worry about unless that animal is acting strange.
I'm curious, are there types of wild animals that we should encourage to be in our midst, that we would like to grow their populations? You mentioned birds earlier, but are there any other types of animals that could maybe survive in an urban or suburban context with a little help from us, and it would be beneficial if we helped them?
Yeah, birds are the big group. The other thing that comes to mind is pollinators. So many of our pollinators are suffering because there's a lack of native plants available. So native plants means plants that have evolved in this area. And native plants often are just necessary for these pollinators to complete their life cycle. They either feed on them or they'll lay their eggs on them. And that's where you see caterpillars that eventually turn into butterflies, that sort of thing. So I've seen success stories in very urban areas where if you plant a few milkweed plants, for example, you will have monarch butterflies come visit those milkweeds, lay their eggs, and then you'll successfully be helping grow their populations. So that's definitely one thing people can look into. You don't need a lot of space. You know, even if it's just a balcony and you want to have a few native plants, like in a pot setting, like that would be very beneficial.
I want you to talk about some of the other benefits of urban wildlife, because, you know, are there things that they're doing that we don't know about that may be helpful to us, like, you know, keeping certain critters in control, something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Things like coyotes and foxes, they eat a ton of rodents. So definitely helping keeping the rodent population under control. A lot of them are scavengers as well. So if something dies or gets hit by a car, oftentimes those same animals will be scavenging that carcass. So they're helping to, you know, recycle that nutrients back into the environment. There definitely are benefits to having those things around.
You know, I can't imagine that urban and suburban sprawl is great for wildlife overall. However, is there a way to develop, you know, new land that's less harmful to wildlife, that encourages coexistence? And maybe the answer is just no. But I am curious if there are sort of like middle paths available, you know, as the human footprint does expand.
Yeah, it's really difficult. And we're seeing this a lot where we have a few species that are doing really well around people. And then the majority of species are just not doing well. So that's hard to answer. I really encourage the use of native plants in landscaping.
Yeah.
We have whole courses about it because most of our landscaped plants are not from the U.S. Most of them are from Europe or Asia. So they're basically statues in terms of providing habitat for things like birds and butterflies and other pollinators. So that's my biggest advice. If you are living in a suburban area and you have a bigger piece of maybe lawn that you're not utilizing, because lawns are basically biological deserts. They're not providing much habitat for anything. Maybe a bird that likes worms, but that's about it. So creating more of that more natural type landscaping that we're not used to seeing, because it looks a little messy and that's not really the American standard of landscaping that we're used to. But that's my biggest advice. And even if we got, you know, those big lawns in front of corporations where all you see is deer and geese.
Yeah.
If that was turned into a meadow, that would be unbelievably beneficial for a lot of those species that aren't doing as well.
Meadow chic. Let's make it happen. And milkweed. Yeah. Let's get some milkweed in the ground there.
Yeah. By the way, I want to read another comment. Lauren says she sees skunk, groundhog, and raccoon families. Bald eagles, hawks, all the time.
Bald I love eagles, it. All the time.
Yeah,
wow.
All the time around in urban areas. So I got to ask you, we only have a couple more minutes, but I wanted to ask you about bats.
Sure.
Folks have been seeing them around. Just what should we be concerned about? Can they be helpful?
Bats are unbelievable. They are really our only nocturnal predator of insects. So all of our bats here in the Northeast, they are only eating insects. They are really great to have around. And some of our species are more adapted to suburban and urban environments. There's one species called the big brown bat and another one called the little brown bat. They're not very creative names. They
Keep
have
it simple,
adapted.
Yeah.
Exactly. They have adapted well to using man-made structures to roost in. So either your attic or a barn or that sort of thing, they will form a colony. And colonies are always made up of female bats and their offspring, which they have in the spring. So they are really great to have around. They do get blamed a lot for spreading rabies. The reason for that is because you're more likely to see a bat in your living room than you are a raccoon, because they can get inside of people's homes. But really, in reality, probably less than 1% of bats actually carry rabies. And rabies can be carried by any wild mammal. So if you get bit by a bat or bit by any wild mammal, you need to get rabies vaccinated immediately, because it is 100% fatal. It's extremely rare, but again, you don't want to mess around with it, because once you're infected with it, it's,
yeah, it's serious.
Not good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But real quick, I could do a bat house. I could build a bat house. That would be a good thing.
Bat houses are great. They work especially well if, say, you had bats living in your attic,
okay,
and you got them professionally removed. We call that an exclusion,
where
you put up a one-way device, the bats leave, and then you put a bat house nearby, they can move in.
And
well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Kathleen Kerwin, Associate Wildlife Biologist at Rutgers. I learned a ton. Thanks, Kathleen.
Me too.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Coming up next, Bakari Sellers. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Eric.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. There was a lot of hope that when the Black Lives Matter movement expanded after the murder of George Floyd, that it would rectify some of the racial injustices in America, from inequities in education to the criminal justice system. But our guest, CNN political analyst Bakari Sellers, says those efforts to right racial wrongs have not panned out. In fact, he argues there's been a powerful backlash. Think about the school bans of African-American books, the dismantling of DEI programs, and the rise of white nationalism.
Bakari Sellers' new book is called The Moment, and it explores why the promise of a racial reckoning never materialized and offers a prescription for realizing political and social justice. In addition to being a CNN analyst, Sellers is also an attorney and was a state representative in South Carolina, making history as the youngest member of the South Carolina state legislature at just 22 years old. Bakari Sellers, welcome to Studio 2.
I'm glad to be here with you guys. Thank you for welcoming me to this amazing city.
Yes, and you're not 22 anymore.
No, I'm not. My back tells me I'm not 22 all the time.
But let's talk about your book a little bit, because the subtitle is Thoughts on Race Reckoning, on the race reckoning that wasn't, and how we can move forward now. And in the book, you sort of discuss about this start of what many people thought was going to be this third reconstruction after the killing of George Floyd. And what happened next failed to meet the moment. Can you lay out your argument?
Yeah, I mean, I start the book with a couple of images. And the one that's probably the most profound, which is where we got the name from, was when I was on air. And I was actually on with Dante Stallworth. This was after George Floyd was murdered. And in the segment before me was Felonious Floyd, George's brother, and Ben Crump. And this is back in the time when we were still in our homes. I was doing TV from my dining room table with my pajama pants on and my suit jacket. And my hair was scruffy. Don Lemon says I look like a young Teddy Pendergrass. And my twins were in my bed with my wife and I. And I went up and went to the kitchen, and in my daughter was upstairs, and in that moment, you could hear the pain of Felonious Floyd. You could hear him articulate what he was going through, and the question was asked of me, you know, what do you do in this moment, particularly for Black children? And I became really emotional thinking about what that pain was and how it felt to be Black in America at that particular time, and I began to cry on air. And it was one of those moments that kind of cut through a lot of the noise, and I think it resonated with people and spoke to people. It was also a moment then where we realized that we could have been on the precipice of change, but I think that many people will see, if you're intellectually honest, you'll see that that change we were hoping for did not materialize, and even worse, it's a legitimate argument to say that we've regressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what is that argument? I mean, what did you hope was going to happen in that moment? And what didn't happen?
So I guess maybe it's my youthful naivete, because although I'm not still 22, I'm only 39. And I think I was hopeful that we would begin to have conversations about how to dismantle these systems of injustice that we have in our country. I mean, we can have a whole show on criminal justice. But that's not necessarily what I'm talking about. That's just a part of it. I'm talking about the environmental injustices that we see. I'm talking about the injustices and inequities we see in our healthcare delivery system. For example, Black women are still 3 times more likely to die during childbirth than white women. I'm talking about a lack of access to capital. I'm talking about a miseducation of our children. I'm talking about an infrastructure system which disproportionately affects poor people and brown people in this country. And so we just simply did not have those conversations. There were a lot of promises made. Many of the promises were kept in regards to dollars going to this program or dollars going to that program. But these systems did not get dealt with. They're still in place today. They're stronger than they ever have been. And then we've seen some steps taken, whether or not it's affirmative action or whether or not it's abortion ban from the 1800s in Arizona, or whether or not it's the efforts to, kind of bastardize the word woke and eliminate DEI. We've seen the efforts on college campuses now to eliminate scholarships for Black folk, attacks on the Fearless Fund. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. But even more importantly, I think that we've seen a manifestation of racism become more outward. We're all old enough, although this is the youngest interview cohort that I've seen in a very long time. We're all young enough to remember when racists stayed inside or they were in the shadows. Mm-hmm. And now I make the argument that we've taken away the white hoods and sheets with the eyes cut out, and now they have Brooke Brothers suits in their own, travel talk radio shows or primetime spots on cable news.
To what do you attribute that?
A monetization of racism. I think what we've seen is there's been an inherent value placed on that. We call out the names in the book. We talk about Tucker. We talk about Sean Hannity. We talk about Clay Travis. We talk about all of these individuals because right now there is a value that's been placed on that. It's been monetized. And so that's why it's been able to find a place in a home in society. No further than I'm sure both of you guys have X accounts. And I'm sure that if you just objectively looked at your X account, that you have seen what has been a consistent rise in anti-Semitism, racism on your Twitter feed since you started this probably back in 2010 or 2012.
And I want to talk to you because you cite a number of problems that made this racial reckoning fall flat. And by the way, you come from a activist family, and we'll talk about your dad a little bit and his influence on you in a moment. But you kind of say that one of the big issues was the Black church.
Mm.
And it changed over the years.
I'm still trying to get people to buy the book now. Don't be having a mad.
No. But I want you to make that, and we're not going to give all the spoilers, but that was a big issue. And I was like, wow, that was fascinating that you saw this change in the Black church.
You know, my father was one of the founding members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And the Black church during the 40s, 50s, and 60s was more than a place for spiritual nourishment. It was a place in which individuals went to organize. It was a place in which individuals went to mobilize. It was a place in our community which held a position of change, right? It was a forward-thinking place of change. It was an exchange of ideas. I mean, the conversations that were being had, I think, immediately to Dr. King's letter from the Birmingham jail. He was writing that letter to other Black folk, particularly other Black ministers, right? But it was just this bastion of an exchange of ideas. And I think now I know I'm generalizing, and I do that purposefully because I want the dialogue to be decently provocative. I want people to want to be engaged in this conversation. I know the work the AME Church does. I know that there are probably some select churches that do. But for a whole or on a whole, one of the things that we've seen a lot like racism, we've seen the capitalism kind of permeate throughout the doors of the Black church, where now there's a question of how many likes can we get, or how good can our musical selections be, or how big can our church be.
The ATMs in the back of the church.
Cool with all of that, right? Mm-hmm. If you do the work. And that's the thing. You have to be able to do that work, not just on Sunday morning, but you have to be willing to do that work Monday through Saturday as well. You know, it's no reason to say that you have the largest church here or whatever it may be if you're not offering mammograms, if you're not making sure the kids have an opportunity to come to your school to learn, if you're not organizing, mobilizing, gassing up church vans, making sure they're voting in local elections. All of those things are necessary. And that's what the Black church was. The question is, what will the Black church be? Because right now it ain't that.
But don't you also argue that the messaging has changed? There's this focus on prosperity preaching.
Of course.
And for someone who's not familiar, I mean, explain what that is and how you feel it runs counter to the spirit of the black church from prior generations.
Yeah, you know, I'm, you know, prosperity preaching, I think for those who do not understand what it is, I would point you directly to Joel Osteen. That is that's the best example I can give you, right? And one of the things that is a newer phenomenon, the Kenneth Copelands, even the Creflo Dollars of the world, that's a newer phenomenon where you literally can get in the pulpit and you've seen the clips, I'm sure, on Snapchat or TikTok, and people tell you about how big their plane is, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about is getting to the root of making sure that black folk not only can survive, but thrive, right? And what that means is we have to get beyond this kind of prosperity gospel and begin to talk about how we're going to destroy systems of oppression and rebuild them in an image that looks like us.
One of the interesting things is you were raised, your dad, Cleve Sellers, was a well-known civil rights activist, worked alongside John Lewis, all the greats during that era, and almost died in a racial massacre in 1968. Tell us about your dad and what it was like sort of growing up in the shadow of someone who was in it. Like all the way in the movement. Yeah.
So I tell people that I'm a product of the proverb, it takes a village to raise a child. My village was so dope, though, because like, you know, Uncle Jesse and who's Jesse Jackson and Julian Bond is like my hero. I love Uncle Julian. May he rest in power. And, you know, Marion Barry and Kathleen Cleaver used to call, and Judy Richardson and all of these people whose shoulders I stand upon. And when I write my books, this is my second one that I've written, I like to tell stories about them so that their plight can be illuminated as well. In fact, in the introduction, I starred with an image of my dad and John Lewis and Jim Foreman, and they are they've just been arrested, and they were being bonded out by Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte. And it's a unique picture because it's this intersection of kind of black wealth, black popular culture, black entertainment, and grassroots activism, and how they came together to kind of put their shoulder to the wheel to get us out this ditch. And me and my father begin to have this conversation about kind of where we are. My dad, February 8th, 1968, was shot by South Carolina state troopers along with 28 others. Three young men were killed, Henry Smith, Samuel Hammond, and Delano Middleton. They actually tried my father. They tried all the officers who fired shots. They were found not guilty, but they tried my father, and they convicted him of rioting. He became the first and only one-man riot in the history of this country. And so my dad went to jail not once but twice. He went to jail the first time for refusing to go to Vietnam. He went to jail the second time for the Orangeburg Massacre. And so, you know, I feel as if I have a unique opportunity, obligation, and the right to challenge this country and make her better, because the blood of my family literally runs through the soil of this great country.
Yeah. Your father also seems, from what I read in this book, to be pretty pessimistic about where we are right now.
I know, he seems like an ornery old man.
No, but you say he's a gentle guy in disposition, but that his opinions are, you know, sort of pessimistic about where we are, which is kind of shocking to read for someone who has lived in such difficult times and lived through such horrific violence. You didn't even mention that he was involved in what happened in Philadelphia, Mississippi, three civil rights activists murdered there.
He searched for the
So someone who has seen that and lived that, to be pessimistic about why we are now, it's tough to read. Yeah. Can you explain his pessimism?
Yeah, I don't agree with it, right? Which is the funniest part of our conversation. By certain metrics, he's right? Mm-hmm. Tangible metrics, like black home ownership today is the same as it was in 1968, right? Okay, like those are tangible metrics to say.
I can tell y'all have this debate quite often.
Those are tangible metrics to say, like, look, our progress is not where it should be. But I refuse to acknowledge that point that he makes, because I think about Henry Smith and Samuel Hammond and Delano Middleton. I think about Emmett and Medgar and Jimmie Lee Jackson. I think about those individuals who gave what Lincoln called the last full measure of devotion, right? And there are so many people who were shot and killed and know what jailhouse floors feel like, who sacrificed so much. And my problem with that sentiment of my father and many others, I was in a conversation with April Ryan recently in Baltimore on my book stop. She maintains the same position. But my problem with that is that if you take that position, are you saying that the work that they did and the blood that they shed and the lives that were given were done in vain? And I refuse to take that position.
So what's your counter argument, though, that some progress has been made?
My argument is simply this, that in this country, we've made a great deal of progress, but we still have yet a ways to go.
Yeah. A lot of work to be done. I have to, we only have a few more minutes, but I have to talk about your chapter titled The Untapped Power of Black Men. I really think you should expand that to a full book. It was fascinating discussion there. And one of the things that you talk about is you argue that Democrats have failed to take the power of black men seriously, which has led to the erosion of the black male vote. Talk about that and what needs to change.
Yeah, for a long period of time, we've only given black women their flowers, which they deserve them. Right. But we have not paid attention to the plight or listened to the plight of black men and the pain and the struggle that they're going through to make ends meet, to survive, to go through the trauma of what it is to live that experience in this country. That chapter was meant to be a clarion call, like the, you know, how you get in your car and the blinking lights are on and saying, look, we don't have an emergency yet, but we may in the future. Black men are the second largest demographic voting base for the Democratic Party, behind only black women. They don't get treated as such. They don't. My argument is that we need to meet black men where they are, and we need to begin to have conversations where those conversations don't start with us trying to yell or articulate what we believe they should do. But it's also to give them their flowers and listen to them and the pain that they see and they feel that they're going through right now.
And you argue also that this has left the door open for white right wing activists, media to jump in and get a stronghold. Yeah. We see 19%.
I don't believe
so far,
the numbers are going to be that high, but you know,
voting Republican.
Yeah, yeah. I don't believe the numbers are going to be that high, but I'll tell you something even more dangerous, that I don't believe this election to be between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. I think that's a terrible analysis that people fall victim to. I think this election is between Donald Trump, Joe Biden, and the couch. And I think in particular with black men, the couch will be highly successful if we do not begin to pay attention to them. The couch is one of the most amazing candidates we've ever seen because it don't run no ads, but continuously people begin to take that option other than the other two.
And what does paying attention to them look like?
Actually listening to them, having them involved in those conversations, having conversations not just in a barbershop, but making sure that we're meeting them on the front lines, talking and messaging the working class black men. Joe Biden's going to be at Morehouse College, my alma mater, coming up soon for graduation. And when asked what should he talk about, I said Joe Biden should talk about peace globally. It feels like the world's on fire. He should talk about abortion and the role that black men can play in preserving our head of household and making sure that our wives and daughters can make decisions for their own bodies. I said he should talk about voting rights, and he should talk about a black agenda and student loan forgiveness. But if he gets on stage and talks about criminal justice reform for 25 minutes, I will personally riot because black men care more than just about that.
So they feel they've been typecast,
stereotyped by the people who we support the most.
Yeah. And you also mentioned of black men, they say the Democrats are not fighting enough. Now, that's a paraphrase of a longer quote, but that struck me, not fighting enough. Is it something attitudinal about the way the Democratic Party presents itself?
It's an attitudinal type of thing. I mean, a lot of gravitating towards the Donald Trumps of the world is simply because of the presentation of some kind of
is it a machismo type?
It's a machismo. That's a great word to use. Mm-hmm. That's a great word.
And you mentioned,
it just shows that somebody's fighting for you, will fight for you, has the toughness to win a battle for you.
Wow. And you mentioned a couple of commentators that you don't agree with, but that you believe have captured the attention of black men. I think he's mentioned Ice Cube and Stephen A. Smith in the book.
Yeah.
Is that the appeal there?
I think that's anti-intellectualism. Okay. I've had a long discussion about Stephen A. Smith.
That's a separate thing.
Just recently on The Breakfast Club, I think that he appreciates being white adjacent. And so he utilizes his platform somewhat as a useful idiot to prop up those individuals like Tucker and like Sean Hannity. And Sean Hannity and others. And I think that he does a great disservice to our community. But that, I do mention those people in the book as black men who are individuals who we have to hold accountable as well.
And you also talk about the need to reunite the black vote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, we cover a lot of bases in this book. And I tell everybody, you ain't going to agree with everything I say, but maybe we can have a constructive dialogue.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot we didn't get into here, but you'll read about that, folks, in the book. It's called The Moment. It's by Bakari Sellers, our guest. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that, friends, wraps up our show for today and the week. Our producers are Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Al Banks is our engineer. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 at WHYY here in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. I'm off next week, Cherry.
Oh, we're going to miss you.
So I will see you guys the week after that. And I know the show will be great without me, probably even better.
No, we're going to see you soon.
I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks, y'all.